This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. When did you last look up your health symptoms online, and what did you learn? Before the internet, if you felt sick, maybe you flipped open the Family Medical Encyclopedia. You checked the flowchart, you followed it all the way down, and you tried to decipher the medical jargon. Now, diagnoses are just a few clicks away, but it's a struggle to trust or even know what to do with the information we find. My guest today noticed that more and more of his patients were showing up at his office with anxiety from self-diagnoses. So the cardiologist and his colleague decided to write a book to help out their patients. In common language, the book easily points readers towards one of three tiers of advice: take a chill pill, make a doctor's appointment, or get to the ER. We continue our embodied series today with a conversation about health anxiety. Dr. Kelly is with me in studio. He's a cardiologist at North Carolina Heart and Vascular and Rex Hospital in Raleigh, and the co-author of Am I Dying? A Complete Guide to Your Symptoms and What to Do Next. Dr. Kelly, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So I think I'm the perfect person to interview you about this because I love Googling my health symptoms. I do have multiple doctors in my family, but there's something really satisfying about being able to get exactly the answer that I want when I go on the internet and look for what's going on. So tell me about kind of what did you notice about the people that were coming to your office with these kinds of health anxieties?
Sure. So people obviously have been having symptoms since the beginning of people. There's nothing new there. But what is new in recent years is your ability to just put those symptoms into a search engine and get an avalanche of information about what they might be. And our personal experience as doctors, me and my co-author, was that a lot of people were getting information that was making their anxiety extremely high unnecessarily. Many people have had the experience where you plug something into the internet and it tells you that your hangnail is actually cancer and that you should get your affairs in order. And so we wanted to make a resource that was much more accurate, trustworthy, has no hidden agenda, and provides very practical information about whether you need to get medical care or not. And that led to the book.
So you have these kind of three tiers in the book, as we described in the intro, you know, take a chill pill. Okay, go see your doctor. Okay, head to the ER. Why did you choose to use those thresholds to design this book?
So I think for a lot of people, when they experience a new symptom, the symptom is usually not so bothersome that like their life can't continue with the symptom there. But more frequently, they have something and they want to know if it's a sign of something more. Everyone hears stories about somebody who had like a little tickle in their throat and then the next week was diagnosed with lung cancer. And you don't want to be that person who ignores a symptom because you don't know what it means. And then something horrible happens and you're like, ah, if I had just seen a doctor up front. And so for a lot of people, when they come into the office, what they really want to know is the title of the book, Am I Dying? This symptom doesn't really bother me that much, but is it a sign of a bigger problem? And so we wanted to give very practical advice about when you need to get additional medical evaluation or when you can just blow it off and wait for it to go away. You know, in this time, it's really not easy for everyone to get medical care. It's not affordable for a lot of people. So we don't want people to make appointments and spend their money unless it's really necessary.
Okay, well, we're going to put you in the hot seat now and have you answer a question from one of our listeners who was experiencing some strange symptoms. So let's take a listen to a clip from Sandra.
My name is Sandra, and I live in Durham, North Carolina. And sometimes when I am on a run or I'm taking a walk, I will put a foot down, and all of a sudden, it is just like I have shards of glass under my feet. It just is this temporary shock of pain, and I would love to know what it might be because it happens randomly and it never lingers.
So that's Sandra Davidson. She's actually a friend of mine calling in about some strange symptoms. And I'm here with Dr. Chris Kelly, the co-author of the book, Am I Dying? A Complete Guide to Your Symptoms and What to Do Next. So is she dying?
All right. It doesn't sound like she's going to die from that.
Okay.
It sounds horrible. So, Sandra, sorry to hear that. So when people describe like glass-like sensations or sometimes electric sensations in their feet, usually that's inflammation of the nerve going to the foot. Sometimes you actually do have glass in your foot, and it's always good to look and make sure there's nothing local happening there. But that sensation is usually nerve irritation. And, you know, for most people, it's not the sort of very rare episodic thing that Sandra has. It's a more constant chronic problem. There's many different causes. It can be compression of the nerve as it comes out of your spine from a slipped disc or arthritis in your spine. It can be from diabetes, which is another very common problem. It can be from medications. If Sandra's having this very rarely, there's probably not a lot that someone's going to be able to do to make it better, but I think that she can take some reassurance that it's not likely to be a significant problem based on her description.
So talk about this kind of navigating when an individual symptom is something to be taken really seriously versus when it's something that we can kind of put on pause, check back in, wait to see if a pattern emerges. Because I would say that for someone with health anxiety like me, the second a symptom happens,
of course,
I'm going to Google.
Yeah. I mean, there's no hard and fast rule. I would say, you know, most of the time if you experience a common illness, like you have a fever, a runny nose, and a cough, that's almost certainly going to be a cold. You know, things like that that we've had before and we've gone through them before, we can usually just wait a few days and see if they go away. It's when you have something totally new and different where you should be a little concerned. So if you never had headaches before or, you know, really never experienced headaches on a regular basis, and now all of a sudden every single day you're having headaches, that's something that should definitely be checked out, because although it could still be a run-of-the-mill headache, it could be a brain issue, and you certainly don't want to miss that. So I think we all know what our baseline is. Whenever you have a deviation from that, you should be suspicious. Most things, if you wait a day or two, are not going to kill you, as long as you're not having severe chest pain, shortness of breath, or anything like that. But, you know, we hope that our book is a good starting point for people. So for whatever symptom they have, and we cover about 40 of them in here, they can go and just get an initial sense if their experience has the flavor of something that may be serious or not.
So I know there are groups of people who are more likely to have their pain dismissed than others.
Yes.
There was a 2016 study showing that Black children with appendicitis were less likely to receive pain meds than white kids. Women in pain are more likely to be prescribed sedatives rather than pain medications.
Yes.
So how do you navigate that as a practitioner and someone writing this book, kind of the ability to validate and take seriously the experiences that people have who have been looked over, but also kind of know where to draw the line between when this is something normal and this is something serious?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime somebody has a symptom that's interfering with their quality of life, it has to be taken very seriously. A lot of doctors make the mistake of ruling out dangerous things and then say, yeah, you're fine. And then the problem hasn't been solved, right? You see that the problem is not a manifestation of a life-threatening condition, but the problem is still there. And so I think that, you know, people, when they see their doctors, should feel like their concerns are being taken seriously, that even if an explanation can't ultimately be found, that steps are taken to reduce the impact of that symptom on their quality of life and not feel like they're being dismissed. And you're right. Unfortunately, there's a lot of biases generally and among doctors in particular about certain populations, you know, having more health anxiety, certain populations having more or less susceptibility to pain, and that results in people not getting the appropriate treatment that they need.
All right, we're going to throw another clip at you. This is a listener who left us a message about anxiety, actually, and the health complications that her anxiety causes.
My name is Bree Sikorsky, and I live in Durham, North Carolina, and I, like many other people, experience anxiety. And for me, this has actually brought a lot of issues from, you know, heart palpitations, dizziness, nausea, to even muscular tension that has actually made me think, you know, it was a heart problem. And so I would be really interested to hear about, you know, for folks that have anxiety or other, you know, conditions that lead to psychosomatic, really intense psychosomatic symptoms, kind of how to handle those and when to know that it might be worthwhile seeing someone versus not.
Sure.
That was listener Bree Sikorsky. I'm talking with Dr. Chris Kelly, a cardiologist at North Carolina Heart and Vascular and Rex Hospital. So talk about those psychosomatic disorders. There's an added complexity there.
Yes. So as a cardiologist, I deal with this all the time. Palpitations, as Bree mentioned, is a very common symptom that can be caused by anxiety, and it can also be the cause of anxiety. And I think it's important for doctors and people in general to understand the arrow goes in both directions, right? Anxiety can manifest in many, many different ways. It can cause a lot of different somatic symptoms, and panic attacks can look for all the world like a heart attack. On the other hand, people who have certain symptoms can experience a lot of anxiety as a result of those. And don't make the mistake of thinking the anxiety is the primary thing. For example, if you have an arrhythmia, an abnormal heart rhythm, that periodically sends your heart rate into the 200s, you're going to feel sweaty, short of breath, freaking out like the world is ending appropriately, and feel a lot of anxiety. And if that happens often, you can get like a kind of PTSD from this symptom. And if you're a young, otherwise healthy woman in particular, people are going to be inclined to dismiss you as just having a panic attack, whereas the arrow is actually going in the other direction. So I think anytime somebody has recurring symptoms that they think may be from anxiety, that may be true, but you should probably see someone to make sure there's no primary issue happening. And if at the end of the day, no underlying problem can be found other than the anxiety, you know, then you can focus on that. But you don't want to make the mistake of just assuming that everything is just in your head. There are many treatments for anxiety, which take many different forms, depending on how you experience it. You certainly shouldn't suffer with anxiety. So even if this is the only diagnosis, you should still get help and not suffer unnecessarily. But I think everyone should get the initial evaluation to suss that out.
I want to talk a bit about tracking, because health tracking is a big part of all of our lives now. When people are wearing smartwatches, we have a sense of our heart rate and how that's changing. We have more access to, you know, getting our genetic history and learning about what diseases are more likely in our family. And there's a way you could read all of that and say, that's great. Like, the more information, the better. I'm going to have a great baseline of my heart data from the past 4 years that I can use if I ever have a problem. What do you say to this this want to track and to know more and to collect more?
So I think we as a society are in a place right now where we are in love with data, and we are collecting it all the time in unbelievable amounts, from everything we do online and on social media to, as you say, increasingly in our personal well-being and health. A lot of people are tracking their heart rate all the time, even if they don't know it, just by wearing a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or a similar device. But there's a whole movement now towards biohacking, where people want to quantify everything they possibly can about their own bodies, with the belief that by having all this information, you'll be able to somehow act on it to make your health even better and your life even longer. Unfortunately, I would say that our ability to collect data is far ahead of our ability to interpret and act on that data. People come to me with mountains of information, their chromosomes being sequenced by commercial companies, their heart rate for the past 4 years, as you say, from their Apple Watch, pictures of their electrocardiogram, which you can now get from your Apple Watch. If you have a specific symptom, it's really helpful to have that information. If you have palpitations and you have EKGs or electrocardiograms from the time of your palpitation, that's extremely helpful. But if you have no symptoms and you're an otherwise healthy person, it's harder to know how to act on that information. If your average heart rate is, you know, 80 instead of 70, there's no concrete advice we can really give other than, you know, exercise regularly, which we would tell you to do anyway. And the same thing for a lot of the genetic information that people get. You know, you find out after getting these tests done that you're at slightly increased risk for various diseases. That's great if there's a way to lower that risk, but there isn't for a lot of those conditions. And so you just know that you have this problem. It may cause issues later in life. It may not, but there's nothing you can really do about it. And I'm not really in favor of that sort of practice, just because it causes stress unnecessarily.
Right. It brings up the idea that, I mean, medicine is not a precise science, right? There's still, you're interpreting.
Of course.
Based on symptoms, you're interpreting based on data. So even if, you know, all of us got an MRI, an X-ray, a brain scan, you know, a full body scan every single year, that wouldn't necessarily mean any of us would be healthier or live longer, because there are false positives. There's so many reasons why that level of testing would just be inappropriate.
Yeah, exactly. On the contrary, in fact, your health may get worse.
Right.
Because there are people who,
exposure to radiation,
who want to get full body CT scans or MRIs in addition to the radiation you might get from the CAT scan. Maybe you find something and it's of unclear significance, and then you undergo further tests, maybe even a biopsy to figure out what it is. And at the end of all that, it turns out to be nothing, and it never would have caused any problems, and you never would have known about it except for the fact that you were, you know, trying to quantify everything about yourself. Now, on the other hand, there are times where people do find things and they would have been problems in the end. And I think our job as physicians and as scientists is to try to understand which tests are more likely to yield useful information and which aren't. But we're kind of far from that when it comes to a lot of these commercial data collection things that are out there.
Okay, we're going to throw one more clip at you. Here is one more listener who has a health question.
I'm Dana from Greensboro, and I want to know what causes unexplained nausea, like between meals or just sitting around and being suddenly really clammy and nauseous. Like you might throw up, but you don't. It's almost like being car sick without being in a car. Thanks.
So that was listener Dana Publicover calling in about something I think a lot of folks have felt and maybe never questioned. I'm here with Dr. Chris Kelly, the co-author of the book, Am I Dying? A Complete Guide to Your Symptoms and What to Do Next. So what's your take on that?
Nausea. Nausea is a horrible symptom. It's like, you know, right up there among the worst things that you can go through because it is debilitating if you have severe nausea. And, you know, when we treat people with advanced diseases like cancer, nausea is often like one of the bigger issues that we face. In what sounds like an otherwise healthy person on the phone, nausea is less likely to be a life-threatening condition but can still really interfere with quality of life. There's many causes. If you're nauseated for just a few days and then it goes away, you probably just had a viral infection of your stomach called gastroenteritis. If your nausea lasts a little longer than that and you're female, you should definitely get a pregnancy test because that is an extremely common cause of nausea, and often that's how pregnancy is diagnosed. And then, you know, there's a lot of medications that can cause nausea as a side effect. So if you've started anything in the relatively recent past, you should mention that to your doctor. Interestingly, marijuana use can cause nausea. This is an unusual phenomenon among frequent marijuana users. They experience very frequent nausea that gets better if they take a hot shower or bath. Hmm. So if you find that you're smoking a lot of marijuana and you love standing in the hot shower all day long, then your nausea is probably from that. If you're actually vomiting frequently, if you have abdominal pain, then that would point towards maybe a problem with your intestines or your gallbladder, and an ultrasound or a CAT scan of your belly would help solve that problem.
So for you as a physician, one of the things you said in the book that I think is interesting is that if you're under 65, an annual or regular checkup may be overkill if you're not taking prescription meds.
Yeah.
So that actually really surprised me because I thought you were going to say, you know, don't worry about these day-to-day symptoms. Just come see a doctor once a year and we'll check you out and it's all good. But that's not exactly your response.
No. So we have an entire chapter at the end of here called Turns Out You're Fine, where we try to give people recommendation about what they should do if they don't have symptoms. And yeah, if you're under 65, an annual physical actually has no proven benefit. If you have a new symptom, then you can do a focused history and physical based on that. But there's really no reason if you're feeling completely fine to take off your clothes once a year for a doctor to examine you. There are a lot of important screening tests and vaccinations that need to happen along the way. You should see a doctor at least every couple of years to make sure you're up to date on that. And we provide details of that in the book. But you know, the sort of annual physical is kind of becoming a passing fad, I think.
So I know this is counter to what you're trying to say in your book to some degree, but if we are going to go online and Google our symptoms, are there places that are better to go than others?
Absolutely. So there are some very reputable sources online if you don't want to get the book. So the National Institutes of Health has a lot of content online about a variety of symptoms and diseases. Top medical schools and academic medical centers like the Mayo Clinic and Harvard have information up there, which is generally very reliable. I would urge people to stay away from blogs, message boards, websites that are selling something, websites that are backed by a single person who isn't a mainstream physician, because you may get a lot of fringe recommendations there that may not help you and may even harm you. And there's tons of that out there as well. But if you stick to pretty mainstream sources, you can feel fairly confident the information is going to be good.
And as you said, you can kind of confirm anything you want by looking at those message boards. Like they will take you from a tickle in your throat to cancer right
Absolutely.
Away.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whatever your greatest fear is going in is almost guaranteed to be confirmed by someone online.
Yes, exactly.
You know, what we try to do with the book, unlike all those other resources, is number one, present the information in a very accessible and fun way. Actually, we try to be humorous throughout the book. And two, really just keep it focused on symptoms and all the different sort of flavors of that symptom that can happen, so that, you know, you don't have to diagnose a condition and try to work backwards to like, do I have that? You start with the symptom that you have and figure out what it might mean.
Wonderful. Dr. Chris Kelly is a cardiologist at North Carolina Heart and Vascular and Rex Hospital in Raleigh. Also the co-author of Am I Dying? A Complete Guide to Your Symptoms and What to Do Next. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about his book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Violet Bell. Please stay with us.